Because of listeners like you, Preborn has helped to rescue over 67,000 babies. Your $28 to sponsor one ultrasound doubled a baby's chance at life. Your tax-deductible gift saves lives. Please join us in this mission. To donate, go to preborn.com/AFR.
Jenna Ellis in the Morning on American Family Radio.
I love talking about the things of God because of truth and the biblical worldview.
The U.S. Constitution obligates our government to preserve and protect the rights that our founders recognize come from God, our Creator, not our government. I believe that Scripture in the Bible is very clear that God is the one that raised up each of you, and God has allowed us to be brought here to this specific moment in time.
This is Jenna Ellis in the Morning.
Good morning. It is Friday, September 5th, and a lot of legal news coming down the pike from, you know, some interesting judges, we'll just put it that way, but this coming from Politico. A judge rules Trump can't act as national police chief. So the president, according to this judge, broke the law when he deployed troops to Los Angeles. A federal judge has declared. So according to Politico, the federal judge in a 52-page ruling warned that President Trump appeared intent on, quote, creating a national police force with the president as its chief. So this judge barred Trump's use of military troops in Los Angeles, barred the Pentagon from using National Guard members and Marines from performing police functions like arrests and crowd control. So what's really going on here? Let's welcome in Gerard Folletti, who is senior counsel at the Lawfare Project. So, Gerard, this seems like a good idea to not allow a national police force with the president at its chief as its chief to come in and override the state sovereignty in terms of policing. But at the same time, when you have legitimate instances where the National Guard can be mobilized, and especially when you're looking at some of these Democrat-controlled cities that are not actually enforcing law and order, how do we parse this legally?
I think we parse this legally by looking at the framework under which the president can activate and federalize the National Guard, and that is when the president is unable with regular forces to execute the laws of the United States. Now, the laws of the United States aren't local laws, to be fair. They are federal laws. They are, for example, immigration laws. They would be federal crimes that are being enforced or that local authorities are not able to assist in enforcing. So that's really what it comes down to. It's the president has this power, but it has to be in pursuit of enforcing federal law, not local law. So if you have someone who is shoplifting, for example, that's not something that you want a national police force for. That's something that's left up to local law enforcement. But when you have federal crimes that are being ignored or not followed up on, no arrest being made, then the president does have that power to use the National Guard.
Yeah, and I think that's a good delineation of, you know, the separation of jurisdiction. And so, you know, this is a decision in Newsom versus Trump's, of course. California Governor Gavin Newsom is sort of parading this as a win. But what is the core of the ruling and the specific actions that the judge found unlawful, the kinds of tasks that the federal troops were performing that crossed those jurisdictional boundaries?
Well, the ruling's highly problematic because I think the judge got it wrong, and I think that on appeal, the Ninth Circuit will see that the judge got it wrong. In part, what this comes down to is the court looking at some of the functions that were performed by the National Guard and seeing that they are law enforcement functions that cannot be done by the military without violating the Posse Comitatus Act. Now, the Posse Comitatus Act prohibits the military from being used to execute the law, to enforce the law. So it's these core functions that the judge here was saying that they're law enforcement functions. But if you look carefully at what they actually are, they do fall within the permissible use of the National Guard.
Interesting. And so even the Ninth Circus, as we've heard it referred to, and I agree, you think even they will see that this is problematic in terms of the core of the ruling?
I think so. And when, to be more specific, what the judge here looked at was the use of the National Guard for security patrols, traffic control, crowd control, and riot control. And the judge found that these are local law enforcement matters, which the National Guard cannot engage in without violating the Posse Comitatus Act. Now, the problem with this is that, in fact, the Guard can engage in these functions, but it has to engage in these functions in the protection of federal buildings or in the protection of federal law enforcement, not in the regular course of business. So this really does become a fact-specific issue as to how the Guard was used. And I think that the facts laid out in this case show that the Guard was used appropriately, and the judge just got it wrong.
And it'll be interesting, and I'm sure that the Trump administration will appeal. So is this different factually than what President Trump is trying to do in Washington, D.C., what he has done, and what he's, I think, threatening to do in terms of taking the National Guard to Chicago?
Well, it's very different because the president controls the National Guard in Washington, D.C. It's not something that he has to federalize. He's already in charge of it. And because of that, we're not looking at the same restrictions as we are in any other state on what the Guard can do. In D.C. and in D.C. alone, the Guard can engage in law enforcement activities without violating the Posse Comitatus Act, because the president serves essentially as a state governor. And when a governor mobilizes the Guard, then the Guard can perform law enforcement activities. So in D.C., it's factually different because the law is different. The president is in charge of that Guard, and he can use it in a much more liberal way than any state governor can.
I'm speaking with Gerard Folletti, who is senior counsel at the Lawfare Project. And, you know, just from a big picture perspective, I think for conservatives who appreciate the functionality of legitimate policing and the fact that we want our streets to be safe, we want to have law and order, we want to ensure that, you know, that people aren't just going into a Walgreens or a CVS and stealing up to, you know, $900 or whatever the ridiculous limit is before they can be stopped. I mean, just seeing some of those basic things that these blue states just seem to not care about, and they're not even enforcing their own laws. That's problematic for everyday Americans. And so when President Trump is trying to deal with these things, overall, I think for conservatives, it's met with, you know, yeah, bring it on. This is a good thing. Somebody is finally telling these leftist governors that just don't really care that they're not going to abide by that. And so is this the best way, though, that President Trump can deal with these problems, or should there be a different avenue for problem solving?
Well, I think this is a good temporary fix, but we have to remember that this is temporary. Using the Guard in this manner, federal law enforcement, is not something that is ultimately going to have a long-term sustained effect on the type of lifestyle crimes, the crimes that most people face on a daily basis, with the exception of Washington, D.C. So using the Guard is a stopgap measure. It's really having troops on the streets deters crime, but those troops cannot stay there indefinitely. That really would become problematic in terms of a national or a militarized police force. So you need to look at the system. You need to see what's broken. And what's broken, as you pointed out, is this progressive policing and prosecution across the country in blue cities that have allowed crime to grow and to fester without consequences. So what President Trump really should be doing on top of this is he should be working with state governors to make sure that there's state law enforcement. He should be empowering cities, perhaps by cutting funding, government funding, if laws are not enforced. That's the issue. We need to address it at the structural level, at the local level, because all this use of federal force, that's only temporary.
Yeah, and that is frustrating and I think problematic. So, you know, it's interesting to me as well that California here argued the 10th Amendment and contended that, you know, of course, the power is not explicitly granted to the federal government or reserved for the states. And it's like somehow magically the left revisits the Constitution and tries to invoke it when it's for their preferred outcome, but they totally ignore it when it's for a different preferred outcome. And so when it comes to the states that are not Washington, D.C., what is the ultimate solution then to places like California, you know, Chicago, New York, elsewhere?
Well, I hate to say it because it's also the tough solution, but to vote them out. It's bringing people into government who understand that crime is a problem and that needs to be addressed. And historically, we've seen successes with this. New York City is a prime example. Before the 1990s, New York City was a cesspool of crime. When I was growing up, it was a scary place to live in. Then New Yorkers elected Rudy Giuliani. He got tough on crime. Crime almost disappeared. Now it's back because we have another progressive mayor. But it is cyclical, and there is a chance to get local law enforcement up to speed. The issue ultimately is that Donald Trump is appropriately using the National Guard to crack down on illegal immigration, which is a federal crime. And in so doing, it is improving local quality of life because there are a lot of criminal illegal aliens who commit a lot of crime, and getting them off the streets does have the benefit of improving local communities. But again, that's federal law. The local issues need to be addressed at the local level.
Mm-hmm. And you're right that actually voting the bad policymakers out is unfortunately a lot of a difficult task. But that raises the question that we've talked about on air before, but it's definitely relevant to this conversation. And that's the census that President Trump has called for and ensuring that only U.S. citizens and those eligible are actually not only voting in elections, but also are making up the composition of the representatives in the state on the local and the national level. And that is poised potentially to have a huge impact on our next elections and including, of course, the Electoral College for the presidency. So how do you see that factoring into some of, not just on the election front, but some of these types of issues overall, a little more broadly?
Oh, I think that would have a huge impact. When you look at what the census does, it's really two things. One is apportioning representation based on population density. So you have a lot of illegal immigrants. They don't tend to live in rural red communities. They live in large blue cities. And when you count them as part of the population in the census, that gives these cities an outsized representation at the federal level. So they get more representatives because of the presence of those illegal immigrants. Now, the other problem with that is the census is used for apportioning resources. When you have a lot of people, you get more funds from government. And that actually is what feeds this problem of illegal immigration in sanctuary cities, because there's no motivation, there's no impetus to get these people out. They're just receiving money from the government and drawing more resources that could go to other Americans who need them.
Yeah. And I mean, and this is where the law matters and getting things right matters. And the only reason it appears that the Democrats and those on the left are objecting to correct apportionment and correct viewing the census numbers and all of that is because they know that this will negatively impact their party. And so this is where, again, it frustrates, I think, a lot of people who are viewing the situation in California as saying, okay, well, you're only using the Constitution and the law and other things when it is advantageous to your preferred outcome. But they're not, the Democrats certainly aren't looking at the overall precedent. And it does seem like when conservatives are concerned about precedent, and we should be, but often that will then come with some concessions or perhaps not as robust of a fight. And so, from that standpoint, and especially all of these judges that seem to be more outcome preferred than actually concerned about precedent, where should the line be for conservatives in, pushing some of these things and saying we want to fulfill Trump's agenda, but ensuring that that precedent still matters and moving forward even after a Trump administration?
I think in part we need to be, or the Trump administration rather, needs to be careful in how it frames its arguments, because the ultimate goals that it's looking to accomplish, whether it's illegal immigration or deportation or economic changes like tariffs, they're all very achievable under the existing laws, but you have to actually tailor your arguments in that way. For example, when you are deporting someone, you want to emphasize the conduct of that person, not the speech, because we already have this case law on First Amendment, and even though it conflicts with immigration law, that's what judges rely on. If you focus on conduct instead of speech, you get around that issue. You're able to accomplish your deportations without the long legal fights. Same with the National Guard. If you tailor your arguments to say that they're not engaging in law enforcement activities, that's a much more winnable argument than trying to argue that there are exceptions that allow the president to do this. So everything that Trump is trying to do is really achievable under the law, under precedent, but the administration really needs to be mindful of that and argue things properly.
Yeah, and that's really the key of it, is to argue things properly and not just potentially weaponize, you know, some esoteric legal argument to then get the outcome that they can right now, but it's not ultimately going to prevail later on down the line. But last question for you, Gerard Folletti, Senior Counsel of the Lawfare Project. You can follow him on X. I'd encourage you to do so. When it comes to a lot of these judges then that are making rulings like this one in California, that it seems like it's just over and over again, we have these leftist activist judges that aren't caring about the correct outcome and so forth. It seems like there's a lot of forum shopping going on. It seems like Congress and the Senate is just allowing a lot of Trump's nominees to kind of sit around waiting. And if that happens after the midterms, there could even be some blocks until the election in 2028. I mean, a lot of these things are problematic when it comes to the bench. And so at least for now, the U.S. Supreme Court seems to be at least better composed in terms of conservatives. But for the future, you know, how difficult, or I guess the question is, you know, why is it so difficult to have a separate independent judiciary that is just not so bent on activism instead of actually being correct in their analysis of the Constitution and the law?
I think there are two issues. One of them is who actually gets appointed, approved by the Senate for federal judges, and that requires us to pay more attention to who we voted to office in the Senate. I think that's why Trump is brilliant in pushing for a 2026 convention, because he does need to highlight why we need to send conservative senators and conservative congressmen to Congress, because we don't want these activist judges. We want better judges. The other part of it is law schools themselves. We've gone in America from, you know, when I was in law school, we learned the law. We learned how to think, how to analyze. Now you're learning DEI, you're learning gender identity, you're learning all of the liberal left-wing propaganda that is actually influencing how these future lawyers and future judges think about things. So the danger really is in academia, it's moved so far to the left, including in law schools, that that's why you're getting these people on the bench to begin with.
Yeah, well, it's problematic across the spectrum, I think, and we need some real practical solutions and not just the outcomes. I mean, I think that what you're highlighting, Gerard Folletti, is that, you know, we need to kind of, you know, roll back a lot of these really damaging precedents so that it's not just about getting the outcome that is the best, whether that's, you know, for or against Trump, for or against Newsom. It should ultimately be the best for precedent. But we need to make sure that we have good and competent judges. We have the right legal arguments. I mean, all of these things matter ultimately to the outcome, because, you know, as the phrase goes, you know, bad facts make bad law. And if we are dealing in a world that is not really focused on what is best overall for the country, it's just so politicized, then, you know, we get to a lot of these problems. But we're going to have to take a break right here, and we will be back with more here on Jenna Ellis in the Morning. I want you to picture this. Her name is Kayla. She is 17, alone, terrified, and pregnant. Sitting in a clinic, tears blurring, thinking abortion is her only option. Until she was offered a free ultrasound, paid for by a hero just like you. The moment Kayla heard her baby's heartbeat, the decision was made. And today, her little baby boy, Gabriel, is thriving because preborn walked with Kayla every step of the way. Now multiply that by 38,000. That's how many babies preborn has helped save just this year. How many mothers preborn has come alongside with practical and spiritual resources to make motherhood possible. But here's the most important thing you will hear today. Their goal is to save 70,000 babies by the end of the year. And they can't do that without us. Every $28 provides that ultrasound, the moment everything changes. Will you be the reason the next Kayla chooses life? The reason Gabriel fulfills his destiny? To donate, dial #250 and say the keyword baby. That's #250 baby, or donate securely at preborn.com/AFR. That's preborn.com/AFR.
Welcome back to Jenna Ellis in the Morning on American Family Radio.
Welcome back. Well, speaking of the crackdown that President Trump wants to enforce with sending the National Guard into places like Washington, D.C., L.A., and even Chicago, during a press conference this past weekend, Mayor Brandon Johnson said that Chicago could see National Guard troops in the area within days, and he signed an order aimed at resisting planned immigration crackdown and possible National Guard deployment. This coming from ABC. So he's taking new steps to fight President Donald Trump, and he signed this order titled Protecting Chicago, which I find very ironic as a title, as I'm sure many of you do. This executive order on Saturday, as the Trump administration prepares to conduct a major immigration enforcement operation, which will start any day now. Sources say hundreds of immigration enforcement agents could be coming to Chicago. And so let's welcome in John Cardillo, who is a GOP strategist, former NYPD. And, you know, as I was talking with the last guest in the last segment, John, I think that for most Americans who want to see law and order, who want to actually see places like Chicago and New York and L.A. Get cleaned up, and they're tired of these, you know, woke leftist idiots who are running these cities and municipalities from, you know, just basically turning a blind eye and saying, yeah, you know, well, we don't really care. And, you know, we want America to be overrun by, you know, crime and all of this other nonsense. The average common sense American is applauding President Trump for doing that. Yet it seems to be a little bit on perilous legal grounds. But what say you?
I don't even know why it's on perilous legal grounds. I think it's a tremendous effort. It's incredibly successful. In Washington, D.C., went from one of the most crime-ridden cities in America with some of the worst quality of life issues to being safe. People are walking, friends of ours, Jenna, people that would text with us and say, I was just in D.C., it's a nightmare, I was afraid to walk from my hotel to the restaurant, are posting videos walking around at night. Georgetown is safe again. The Capitol District is safe again. The White House area is safe again. And we know this works. And it works because we've proven it back in New York City in the 90s when Rudy Giuliani saturated the city with cops. My academy class was 2,000 plus. And we had a presence, and it's called directed patrol. It's called creating a police presence. So you've got these morons on social media saying, well, look at this. Taxpayer-funded National Guard just standing around doing nothing. No, they are doing quite a bit merely by standing around armed. It's called directed policing, a massive presence of armed, uniformed people who are going to stop criminals. And it's that simple, right? And the left knows it's that simple. You put a good guy with a gun on a corner in a visible uniform, the bad guys are going to go somewhere else. And when you put those good guys on every corner, the bad guys have nowhere to go, so they go into hiding. It really is, the equation really is that simple.
Yeah, and I mean, everybody knows that law enforcement works. I mean, deterrence works, and when you have police presence, it works. I mean, like, it's so ridiculous to say that somehow that type of presence is not having a massive effect on Washington, D.C. But I mean, but these are the same people, John, who claim that, you know, men can become women. So clearly they're not even dealing in reality. But my last guest was saying, and I agree with him, at least insofar as the legal parsing of saying, well, if Trump is coming into Chicago, for example, on planned immigration law enforcement, then that is obviously a federal subject matter that can be enforced by the National Guard. But if it's coming in, you know, to address something like, you know, traffic tickets or shoplifting or things like that, to use the National Guard for that purpose is likely on more perilous legal grounds. However, I wonder if some of these judges may be just as tired of it, and they may view, you know, some of the enforcement of like the Posse Comitatus Act and some of these other things as saying, you know what, this is legitimate policing, and basically allowing Trump to do this because the Democrats aren't. And, you know, and as much as, you know, I'm an advocate for the precedential value in all of this, I would see some good to a judge actually saying, you know, no, this is okay, because when you have a city that is overrun by crime, that is a problem, and it is a security problem, and there should not be a legitimate reason why a president shouldn't be able to come in and use the National Guard for that purpose.
Yeah, and I don't think, you know, Jenny, you made a couple of great points there. They're not using the National Guard for traffic violations. They're not using the National Guard for misdemeanor arrests. The National Guard is there to be what we discussed a few seconds ago, a deterrent, a presence. Chicago PD is still coming in and making those local arrests, right? The National Guard isn't going to get out there and hold radar guns and stop speeders. They're there because over Labor Day weekend, 55-ish people were shot and 7 were killed in Chicago, and it was business as usual. The city is a war zone. You know, a good friend of mine, his family is pretty affluent. They own this big apartment right across from the Gucci store on Michigan Avenue. Well, they sold it, and the day he went there to do the closing, he was in the apartment and showed me a video of young black males, because that's 99% of the world, 95% of the crime in Chicago, just brazenly out in the open, smashing the windows of the Gucci store and stealing things. So when you have that kind of crime in the best area of the city, well, clearly, the administration, Brandon Johnson's administration, isn't doing a thing to protect Chicagoans. The Chicago PD does a great job. It's a very proficient agency, but their wrists are tied. They're shackled by the mayor's office. I think the president is 100. In fact, I think the president had no choice here. If the mayor isn't going to protect you and Pritzker can't get out of his box of Twinkies long enough to protect the residents of Chicago, well, then who's left up to? The buck stops there. The president of the United States said, sick of seeing people get killed, going to send a presence in here to try to mitigate that problem, to try to stop seeing bodies left on the street. I think the mayor of Chicago should be indicted for his inaction.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you know, Mayor Johnson frames his orders protecting Chicago. I mean, that's utterly absurd, because the politics and policy are quite literally standing in the way of public safety. And the National Guard is a practical solution.
Oh, 100%. Look, Brandon Johnson is delusional. And you know, I'm kind of snickering a little at your intro when he said, you know, we're not going to let immigration agents into Chicago. Well, too bad, Brandon. They are already there. Every federal agent, I think you and I spoke about this, in America has Title 8 authority, most agencies every other month. So what that means is Title 8 authority is authority to enforce immigration law. A good friend of mine here in my neighborhood is a DEA agent. He's under Title 8, so every other 30 days, all he does for 30 days is immigration enforcement. So it's not like Trump is flying these people in. They're simply giving the federal agents in Chicago Title 8 authority to enforce immigration law, and they're deputizing local and state law enforcement to do the same. So there's nothing Brandon Johnson can do, just because the agents and the cops are already there, and it's going to happen.
Yeah, absolutely. And this is a reminder, with this being in Chicago, that the border crisis and immigration enforcement doesn't just affect border states like Texas or Arizona or Florida. Its effects ripple into cities like Chicago, which has declared itself a sanctuary city for years, which is, you know, just laughable and utterly absurd. And so the presence of the National Guard and ICE officers for the purpose of border security and immigration enforcement is rational, it's reasonable, and it is a federal subject matter. And these Democrats really have no standing in terms of objection to this type of enforcement, because that is the law. And it's utterly absurd that they don't care about border security. And that, I think, needs to be a fundamental point that is driven home for the midterms, because if we see, you know, Congress shift and Republicans lose the majority, then a lot of these things that are good policy right now under Trump will not get codified into law, and we won't see as much of an advancement for border security as we might have otherwise. I mean, even in terms of just funding and other things like the One Big Beautiful Bill.
Yeah. Well, look, the biggest problem is the Democrats are in panic mode right now. They were completely dependent upon welfare plantations, illegal immigration, hopefully being converted to citizenship by some pathway to remain in power, because they're not stupid people, Democrats. I believe they're evil people. I believe they're godless people. I believe they're people who root for the destruction of America. But they're not stupid people. And they know that their policy doesn't really resonate with Americans anymore. But they are so entrenched. And they have doubled down on these ridiculous policies that men can be women and rampant crime is a good thing and the border should be open and flooded. So let's use Chicago, right? Chicago is particularly egregious because it has always been a pipeline for the Mexican mafia and its surrogate gangs to traffic drugs for the cartels. It's a direct shot north, from the border, and they can get those drugs easily into Canada, the east coast of the U.S., the west coast of the U.S. So Chicago has always really been a domestic transshipment center for drugs and some of the worst gangs imaginable. Many of those traffickers, those mules, are illegals. So they know they've got a problem. It's why bodies, you can really correlate pretty directly without too many deviations the bodies on the street in Chicago being left on the street in these gang wars to illegal aliens smuggling drugs up across the border. And for the mayor of Chicago to sit there and say, we don't have problems, we don't need help, we've had this conversation. I am a federalist. I believe in the 10th Amendment. I believe in the sovereignty of cities and states until they stop doing their job. Then I have no problem with the federal government stepping in. You know, years back, the New Orleans police was the most corrupt police department in America. There came a point where the DOJ had to step in, and everyone in law enforcement cheered that. So there does come a point where the President of the United States has to say enough is enough, people are dying, and step in. And I think that's going to resonate with Americans, including moderate Democrats, independents, moderates, and non-party affiliates. And that's why the Democratic Party is going down in flames.
Yeah, and I think that the type of message that it's sending to these rank-and-file officers and Chicago residents, if the guard stepped in to reinforce law and order, would be a tipping point, hopefully, to show that the chaos that the left is pushing onto America is not in anyone's best interest. And I think this is where the red pilling of America is happening. And the Democrats know that they are losing the narrative and they're losing the propaganda, mainly because, frankly, there's so much social media and videos and stuff that they just can't control the narrative over what's actually going on.
Yeah, exactly. And look, I'm in about three different law enforcement-only Facebook groups, and that tens of thousands of cops from around the country, around the world, to a man and woman, they are supportive of the National Guard. You might get here and there an appointed police chief or a deputy chief in a very blue city who's beholden to the mayor for their job criticizing it, but you talk to the rank and file. Those men and women on patrol, the ones doing the car stops, going to the domestics, the most dangerous jobs in law enforcement, they are 110% in support of this policy to have the National Guard on the street to supplement their efforts. 100%. I have not seen one cop speak up an objection.
Wow. And that tells you everything, right? I mean, this is beyond politics for the people who are actually on the ground, who see this every day. It's not about Republican versus Democrat. It's just about simple safety, law enforcement, and things that really should not be a matter of Republican versus Democrat. I mean, this is why when we talk about what, like RFK Jr., when he talks about what it used to mean to be kind of an old school Democrat, it wasn't just out in leftist insane world. They still were at least dealing in reality, just maybe had, more big government and different solutions and some of those things, but they were still at least dealing rationally in reality. But we're not dealing with that anymore. And for the people who are promoting these types of sanctuary cities and they don't care about law and order, they're really telling their populace that they absolutely do not care about the standard of living and the American dream and people's families and individual rights and self-preservation. I mean, all of these ideals that we know deep down in our core and we know come from God our creator, but every person knows deep down in their core is all about freedom. And that's really the bottom line, is that Democrats do not want freedom. They want absolute control. And it shows in a variety of ways. And I hope and I pray that more and more people are waking up to how insane the left has become. Do you think that overall, when we look at the voting populace, headed into the midterms, that you know, we're not going to see a country quite as divided now that, you know, President Trump and Doge and, you know, we've seen kind of the difference between Trump then Biden and now Trump again. I mean, I think we've given the American public a lot of really valuable insights, and hopefully they're waking up.
Yeah, I think they are. But, you know, one of the points you just made, which I think is so important to touch back on, it used to be bipartisan. People forget that in the early 90s, Bill Clinton worked with Republicans to pass the crime bill, which gave $400 million direct to police departments around the country to hire more cops, to upgrade their equipment, to, you know, get better firearms, drive better vehicles. And it worked. New York City, I think when I was there, got $30 or $40 million of that money. And look what we did in New York City in the 90s to reduce crime. So this was never a partisan issue. You know, as much as I hate to give credit to Andrew Cuomo for anything, when Bill de Blasio was letting New York City turn into a crime-ridden cesspool, Andrew Cuomo as governor ordered in the state troopers. Even he knew that without public safety, you don't have commerce, you don't have an economy. So this used to not be a partisan issue, and to me, it's just mind-blowing that Democrats are now doubling down to defend criminals.
Yeah, I know. It's absolutely absurd. And, you know, they're allowing anybody and everybody in, and they anybody can do whatever they care to do, except for the fine, upstanding, you know, Bible-believing Christians, it seems like. I mean, it's just so utterly ridiculous and preposterous. But, John Cardillo, we got to take a break here. I'm going to keep you over into the next segment, and we're going to talk about a couple of other headlines. So we'll be right back with more here on Jenna Ellis in the Morning.
Welcome back to Jenna Ellis in the Morning on American Family Radio.
Welcome back, and I'm still here with my very special guest this morning, John Cardillo, who is a GOP strategist, former NYPD, and Florida resident for a lot longer than me, so very jealous of him on that fact. I should have moved to Florida a long time ago, but we share the Floridian stuff in common. And this headline we have to cover, but it's just so utterly ridiculous, in my opinion, John, that, you know, this came out this week that the House Oversight Committee releases thousands of Epstein documents and a vote that formalized the House's inquiry into Jeffrey Epstein. So they released, you know, these thousands of documents related to Epstein's case late on Thursday night. And that came ahead of the House-wide vote to formalize the committee's Epstein inquiry. And it's, you know, the vote, while largely symbolic, and, you know, this actually, Fox News agreed with this, but they said would also direct the House Oversight Committee to release the Epstein files sent by the Department of Justice. That includes nearly 34,000 pages. But to me, like, there is no news here. It doesn't actually, like, this isn't changing anything. This seems to be not really a PR stunt, but more of, like, the GOP trying purposefully to at least reduce the impact of the Democrats' talking point that Trump is somehow shielding the document release because he's mentioned in there negatively. So it's more about that, I think, than the public actually learning anything.
Yeah, I could not agree more. I think we've spoken about this on air. I'll be quick in my explanation. But back in 2007, when DOJ punted the federal case against Epstein and he got that one minor state charge, I was actually met one of the agents on the case. She was working with one of the victim's lawyers. And she said Donald Trump was one of their best assets. He couldn't stand Epstein when he found out about the kids, kicked them out of Mar-a-Lago, and assisted DOJ and FBI in the investigation. So the assertion that there's something negative there on Trump because in the 90s he knew Epstein in the rich guy's social circle in Palm Beach is just preposterous. A lot of people knew Epstein. So I don't think there's anything. And listen, I've been critical of Trump. I got beat up in the primary for backing DeSantis. But I've always defended him on this because I spoke to agents on the case, and they had always indicated that he was an absolute good guy in the entire investigation. You know, what I think this is, Jenna, it's getting annoying. You're 100% right. There's nothing new here. Most of these documents are easily available if you know where to look. If you know how to use PACER, which searches the federal court databases, all the courts, all the filings, all the districts, you can find much of this in the filings for the victims' rights cases, the civil cases. You can look at the cases back in 2007. A lot of this came out. Much of this stuff has been open source for years, but this this like weird romanticization of the Epstein case took hold with QAnon and crazy conspiracy theorists, and people think there are these global pedophile rings that drink babies' blood. No, look, there are trafficking rings out there. And we do DHS is one of the best, HSI, Homeland Security Investigations, that are interdicting and taking them down. And they do a tremendous job. And these rings still operate. And it's a heinous crime. And we should take every one of these people down and make them rot in prison or give them capital punishment. That said, Epstein is red meat for a fringe part of the base. I don't know why the GOP keeps going down this road, because it's going to end poorly, because people aren't stupid. And social media has made them a lot smarter with regards to these things. Ultimately, there's going to be nothing again, and the Republican base is going to start accusing Republicans of a cover-up. They need to treat this pragmatically, come out and say, you've seen everything you're going to see, there is no more. If you don't like it, I don't know what to tell you, but there is no more. You listen to a bunch of influencer pundits who didn't know what they were talking about tell you things existed that didn't. But I do think Pam Bondi did the administration a tremendous disservice, saying the info was on her desk, it would be released. And then a short time later, giving people empty binders. I don't understand that stunt. I don't know what White House or DOJ comms was thinking with that. But that led to all this. So this, to me, is theater. It's red meat, and I couldn't agree more. There's nothing new in there.
Yeah, yeah. And I agree with you, John Cardillo, that, you know, this is more of the red meat for a certain part of the base. And, you know, while...
Right.
You know, of course we want transparency, accountability in general and all this. There just comes a point where it's like there's nothing more here. And yet that part of the base is calling for, you know, more accountability, more arrests and, you know, some of those things, which is fair. But the myopic focus on this particular story, I think is, as you said, going to do the GOP overall a disservice, because it is so ripe with, like, who cares, in a grander sense, that it's so ripe for the Democrats to then focus on that as an attack lane instead of actually having to focus on their own failed policies for the midterms.
Yeah, I mean, again, Bondi handed Democrats talking points on a silver platter, right? But, you know, the base is also a bit misguided. Did they really think – I mean, people believe they're going to get these videos inside the temple on Epstein's Island. It just doesn't exist. There's no list proper. These lists really aren't kept. That's stuff that happens in the movies. You know, what if you talk to people that understand the case and good actors in law enforcement, Epstein and a few guys were the ones into kids. The island was really reserved for wealthy people, powerful people, heads of state, to interact with overage women. And the problem with additional prosecutions is Epstein procured and paid for those women. So what you had at the core were consenting adults engaging in sexual activity, but those men did not pay the girls. Epstein did. Well, Epstein is dead. He's not going to admit he paid the girls. The girls aren't going to wrap themselves out and say, yeah, we were prostitutes. And the guys aren't going to say we went to the island knowing he was procuring prostitutes. Not to mention the statute of limitations has expired on all of this. So I don't know why people believe there are going to be these additional arrests, prosecutions, and perp walks. It's never going to happen for a multitude of reasons.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, and that's unfortunately, I think, the stark reality of the situation. And so, you know, from the more influencer side, and you and I, of course, unfortunately, have to deal a lot in the social media narratives and, you know, some of these influencers that I think they're just there for their own clicks and views. I mean, it's not about actually promoting good policy. It's not about conservatism. It's not even really about President Trump. I mean, it may be about proximity to him, access for, you know, for them. But all it is to promote their own brand. And so a lot of this that is being hyped, and, you know, even a lot of these influencers that went and, you know, held up the binders and all this nonsense before they even knew what was going on, it's all about the clicks and likes to them, and it's about their bottom line. It's an industry for them. And so for listeners here on this network, be very mindful of that, because when you have people who their livelihood depends on clicks and views and drama, basically, then there's an incentive there to continue this kind of story and kind of build that false hope instead of actually telling you things the way that it is, that maybe, you know, the audience doesn't necessarily like, But, you know, that's kind of life, where it doesn't always go the way that we prefer. And so, you know, so I think that there's a real use and abuse, especially within, I mean, both parties, but especially within the MAGA core, that is very problematic and really needs to be called out, John.
Well, 100%. And a lot of these influencers have tremendous traction. You know, they're known plagiarists. They're self-admitted plagiarists. Some have been fired for dozens of instances of plagiarism. They make it up as they go along. They create sources that don't exist. They fabricate source information, and they get away with it. They get away with it because no one on the right calls them out, because, like you said, too many of these people are all jockeying for the clicks, because the clicks make money, and in some cases make a lot of money. These people are making six figures monthly in some cases. And so Epstein, unfortunately, this case is really good fodder for that clickbait and for that revenue. And it's sad. It's sad that they don't care about giving people the truth. They don't care about giving people, an unvarnished analysis. You know, Jody, you nailed it. Look, sometimes investigations don't yield anything. Sometimes they yield what they yield, and they don't have all the sensational details in them that people hype themselves up to believe were there. That's the reality of life. Some investigations go nowhere, even though, you know, you have somebody guilty of sin. Look at OJ. And so people have to start being a little bit realistic about this Epstein thing, because it is taking up way too much oxygen of Republican Party political capital. And I'm afraid this is really going to hurt us down the road. They're going to be able to turn. You know, we've got this, what we're calling the woke right faction of the base, that's now almost touching the woke left, right? They're anti-Semitic. They're pro-Palestinian. They believe any crazy conspiracy theory that bucks any traditional or institutional party line. Now, you and I have beat up the institutions more than anybody, but sometimes things are what they are. And I fear if these things go sideways, in other words, they don't get this sensational red bloody meat, they might vote against us in the next election. They might just sit out. They might protest vote for an independent or a libertarian or a Democrat, and they could really throw the whole thing into chaos.
Yeah, absolutely. And really well said. And I think that we need to be very cautious as consumers of social media, what the incentives of influencers are. I mean, just like what the incentives of, you know, MSNBC and CNN are. I mean, it's really, honestly, at the end of the day, no different. But in just the last couple of minutes I have with you, John Cardillo, I do also want to address very quickly, we are coming up rapidly on the midterms, which also includes a number of governor's races. One of the key races, of course, for 2026 is going to be the gubernatorial election in Florida. And just as of this week, former Florida House Speaker Paul Renner, he was House Speaker from 2022 to 2024, is officially running for governor. So Byron Donalds, congressman, is the only one who had officially declared for the at least the GOP in the primary. So what do you make of Paul Renner jumping into this race?
I think Paul Renner is an outstanding conservative. He did a great job in the Florida House, and he did a tremendous job recently. He sits on the main board of trustees for the Florida State University system, and Renner was really instrumental, one of the people leading the charge against the radical leftist who had been approved by the University of Florida Board of Trustees to be president of that institution. Well, Renner and the main board said, no, 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 and Renner was very vocal about it. He was precise in his questioning. He didn't pull any punches. So I'd always liked him. I dealt with him over the years. He'd been in the Florida legislature for a while. But I was really, really impressed. I've been very vocal about not being a Byron Donalds fan because of his background, criminal background, his affiliations with known career criminals, a lot of questions around his wife's charter schools and millions in missing money. And his support for people like George Floyd. Byron Donald still has a George Floyd eulogy on his website. He sided with Kamala Harris on critical race theory in Florida schools. So it's really good to see an actual conservative like Renner jump in, and I predict, you know, one or two more people who, as good as Renner, will probably jump in soon. So to me, it was encouraging to see him jump into the race. I think he's a good option.
All right, and that's great. You know, I mean, I've always been a fan of a wider bench and a good primary. And, you know, like you, I got, you know, a lot of grief for supporting Governor DeSantis, you know, in the presidential primary. But, you know, my response to the haters was always, you know, this is good that we actually have several conservatives instead of just, you know, elections in the past, let's be honest, where it's like really like John McCain, that was the best that we could do. But, you know, I think that a good primary is always a good thing. And we'll see if Lieutenant Governor Jay Collins steps into that race any time soon as well, as a lot are predicting. So John Cardillo, really appreciate it. You can follow him on X. And as always, you can reach me and my team, Jenna, at AFR.net. Don't miss this week's On Demand, a podcast episode also dropping today at AFR.net. Preborn's whole mission is to rescue babies from abortion and lead their families to Christ. Last year, Preborn's network of clinics saw 8,900 mothers come to Christ. Please join us in this life-saving mission. To donate, go to preborn.com/AFR.